Hollywood myth, murder, and scandal. Where does the truth end and the fiction begin? Join us for an all-access tour through some of the most sordid tales in Hollywood history. These are stories of dashed hopes, unbearable losses, of meteoric rises and savage falls, all from the land where dreams and nightmares are made. This is Tinseltown Tragedies, coming up next on Movie Geeks United. Episode 1, Peg Entwistle and the Hollywood Sign Suicide.
Cradle me where southern skies, and watch me with a million eyes. Sing me to sleep, lullaby of the leaves.
Friday, September 16th, 1932. In the chill of darkened night, a 24-year-old, down-on-her-luck actress named Peg Entwistle ascended the steps of the famed Hollywoodland sign in Los Angeles, climbed upon the first letter, and jumped to her death. Two days later, a woman happened upon a shoe and a jacket while hiking near the sign. The sight of a lifeless body was visible further down the mountain. She also discovered a purse, the single content of which was a simply stated, yet eerily cryptic suicide note.
I'm afraid I'm a coward. I'm sorry for everything. If I had done this a long time ago, it would have saved a lot of pain.
The note was signed with the initials P.E. Unaware of the victim's identity, the police printed the note in the paper, hoping someone would come forward to claim the body. It wasn't long before someone did. And henceforth, a Hollywood myth was born. Peg Entwistle, a struggling ingenue with lofty dreams of motion picture fame in her sights, desperate to stand out and make it big amongst a sea of young girls just like her, finally gave up and took her own life in a symbolic gesture worthy of the most grandiose Hollywood melodrama atop the bright shining beacon of the very industry that killed her. For more than eight decades, that legend has become accepted fact. But the truth is more complicated and heartbreaking.
the stage was her real true love, and that was really what the shattered dream was. It wasn't the old story so much about her coming to Hollywood to make it big on the silver screen. That's not what happened at all.
James Zarek Jr. made it his mission to uncover the truth about Peg Entwistle, who she was, and why she took her own life. For 7 years, he engaged in painstaking research, sifting through volumes of reference materials, speaking to her surviving family members, and indulging in the sacred process of examining many of Peg's personal effects. His efforts are chronicled in an intimate and exhaustive biography titled Peg Entwistle and the Hollywood Sign Suicide.
Now, she was Welsh-born, but she was of English citizenship. Her parents, they were living in West London, in Kensington. And, you know, everywhere around the corner, I mean, there was theater, mostly, you know, Shakespeare, but there was theater everywhere. And her father and her uncle were an actor, and she had an aunt who was an actor. And at 3 years old, Peg's father and uncle performed in a scene from a Shakespeare, from Julius Caesar. During the coronation of King George V, Peg sat in a little pushchair at 3 years old, and that's her first real experience to theater. Everywhere she went, she was surrounded by people in the theater, people in her family. When they went out, they had get-togethers. So it was like in her DNA. You know, we're talking, you know, from 1911 on, you know, when she was three, and she saw this performance in His Majesty's Theater, and there up in the balcony is the King and Queen of England, and she's in the little wings. And, you know, everywhere her family went, her whole life was surrounded by these people. And she was at a show nearly every night, even when she didn't understand the content. She didn't understand the drama or the story. But I knew that she understood the reaction that her father and her uncle and her aunts on her father's side were getting when they were on the stage, whether it was laughter, whether it was tears. And that's what really moved her. And at her earliest age, when they asked her what she wanted to be, she said she wanted to be on the stage, and she wanted to be the greatest actress since Maude Adams.
When Peg was just a little girl, she and her father moved to the States after her father found theater employment opportunities in New York.
Hello, Central, dear. Central, listen here. Please connect me with my father. Number 123, Daddy, this is me. Come home right away.
Soon after that, Peg's father met the future stepmom. Her name was Loretta Ross, and she was the sister of Charles's wife. So the brothers, I think it's very cute that the brothers Entwistle married the sisters Ross. And these were the American sisters from Ohio. And so in 1913, Peg is in New York with her father, and then she likes very much this new woman in their life, this Loretta Ross. And her father marries after a year of proper courting. And now Peg has a new stepmom. And for the next 8 years, you know, things are wonderful in their life. And then poor Loretta, then she passed away of meningitis, and that shattered Peg. And then 18 months later, her father was killed on Park Avenue when he got run over by a hit-and-run driver. Mm. And Peg's aunt, Loretta's sister, Jane, and her husband, Peg's uncle, Charles, they ended up adopting Peg and her two brothers. Her two brothers are her brothers through the stepmom. 4 days before he died of his injuries, Peg's father gave a 7-page detailed will. And in this will, he stipulates that that the two sons are to go to his brother and his wife, and along with Peg, and that Peg is not to be given to his ex-wife, because the courts had given him custody of Peg. And we don't know why they got divorced, and we don't know why the courts had given custody of Peg to her father, Robert. But this occurred in about 1908. So I imagine, and that was in England. So I'm assuming it was probably infidelity, but I don't know for sure.
Do you know what ever happened to her birth mother?
No, I don't. The way the will is worded, it seems as if she was in the States and somewhere in the East, perhaps even New York, because there seems to be a sense of urgency. He's very careful how he words it, and he's careful to detail and make sure that that everyone knows, that all the attorneys know who also co-signed the will, and the other witnesses, that, you know, he does have legal custody of Peg, and he does not want her to go into the custody of her mother.
Following her father's death, Peg and several remaining family members moved to Los Angeles, but it wasn't the promise of fame and fortune in the movie business that led her there.
It turns out that her younger brother, Bobby, had an inner ear infection that was chronic, and he almost died. He ended up with infection, and they had to actually bore holes into his eardrums with little glass tubes to drain out infection. And he nearly died as a fever from the bacteria in there brewing in his brain. And the doctor said to the family, "You have to take this kid to a warmer climate." Well, all these people knew was, you know, entertainment and, you know, mostly stage work. So it made sense to them to come out to Hollywood, specifically Beechwood Canyon out here by where the Hollywood sign is now, because, you know, most of the time, you know, 10 months out of the year, it's dry, and most of the time it's, you know, dry heat. And it also afforded him, you know, the ability to do work because he had connections here. Because there was, stage was still pretty well in vogue here. And then, of course, films were making a real big monumental foothold. So they ended up coming out here, and he bought the little house in Beechwood Canyon. And they already had some family out here on Jane's side of the family, the stepmother, Loretta, and then her sister, Jane. And so at the end of 1923, they came out here and they bought the house. And then later that summer is when they started building the Hollywood Land sign.
One of the most revered and recognizable symbols in the world, the Hollywood sign, or Hollywood Land, as it read when it was first constructed in 1923, was originally intended as a gigantic promotional billboard of sorts for an upcoming real estate project. Today, of course, it has become the emblem of an entire industry and all the seductive dreams that surround it. In retrospect, Peg's arrival in 1923, around the same time the sign was first conceived and erected, is only one of several uncanny parallels that connect her to the sign, and the ultimate fate she would suffer 9 years later. But we're getting ahead of ourselves.
Well, Peg hadn't started acting professionally yet on stage. She was going to some theater schools in Hollywood, and she was mostly reading plays and going to plays and rehearsing scenes, acting out scenes with her aunt, who had now retired to be a full-time mother to Peg's two younger brothers and her. And it's not until Peg turned 17 and they had gone back east to visit Ross family members in Ohio. And at this time, her uncle was working for the A1 Shakespearean actor of the day named Walter Hampton. And Walter Hampton, he was best friends with Ethel Barrymore, and he was the A-list Shakespearean on Broadway. And at a party, a birthday party for Walter Hampton, Peg, she's 17, and she's getting ready to, you know, have her coming out. And she meets at this party a man who was going to start the Boston Repertory, a man named Henry Jewett. He was introduced to Peg, and she knew all about him, and through this conversation at this party, he became really intrigued with her. And he was still putting together a repertory company for the theater that was to open later that October. And Peg had a bed she was supposed to bunk. She got accepted by the brand new Theater Guild School of Acting. You see, and there's another kind of error, a very innocent one, where it says Peg graduated from the Theater Guild School of New York. She didn't actually graduate. She had been accepted, and she was supposed to go there and spend 8 months learning the craft. And her bunkmate was going to be a girl named Sylvia Sidney, who became a very well-known character actress through the years. But what happened instead was when she met Henry Jewett offered her a contract right then and there. And a few months later, Peg is at the Boston Repertory performing professionally, and she stays there the next 8 months. And that's where she has her really big success. And she becomes the toast of Boston. And she becomes Boston's most popular actress. And she becomes the youngest member of a repertory company in the United States. And she did all of Shaw. She did all of Ibsen. She did a little bit of Shakespeare, which she didn't really like all that. And she, she did a little bit of O'Neill. But Ibsen was her favorite. And Shaw was her most challenging. But it's her biggest success first comes when she's 17. And she does Ibsen's The Wild Duck.
It was on the Boston stage in a 1926 production of Ibsen's The Wild Duck where Peg enjoyed her first taste of success as a professional actress. And unbeknownst to Peg, it would also inspire the birth of another career from one of the most legendary acting figures in the history of the cinematic medium. Many years later, this actress would say, "Before that performance, I wanted to be an actress. When it ended, I had to be an actress, exactly like Peg Entwistle."
That was the night in January 1926, just before Peg turned 18, where a young girl named Betty Davis sat in the front row with her mother and saw this magnificent performance. And you see in my book that all the quotes I have about Peg Entwistle from Betty Davis, taken directly from Betty's own words, her own memoirs and interviews, first-person interviews.
You know, Betty Davis being one of the great actresses of all time, when she said something like Peg Entwistle was her personal favorite actress, obviously Peg was phenomenal. That's an amazing anecdote that it inspired her to pursue her own acting career.
Yeah, Jamie, I'm doing research, and and I don't know, I'm still about 2 years away from submitting the manuscript. I find it was a 1976 November, and it was almost exactly 50 years after Betty Davis had seen Peg perform in The Wild Duck. And she was giving an interview for Newsday. And the last question of the interview in this Newsday, almost exactly 50 years after Betty first saw Peg, Al Cohn, he asked the last question, which is, "Were there any actresses after whom you patterned yourself?" And she says, "One." And you could just see Betty Davis, that flamboyant with a cigarette flying in the air. And, And just, she says, "One, Peg Entwistle." And she goes on to talk about, and I actually almost began to weep. I see this thing 50 years later, and I went, oh my God, 50 years have gone by, a half a century, and here's Betty, the great Betty Davis, still giving all the credit to Peg Entwistle.
He said, "Why be greedy?"
Why be greedy?
Those were his last words.
Why be greedy? That'll print well for an epitaph. Thanks.
Okay, stop drooling. Get going, Julian.
That's a scene from The Lineup, a gritty 1958 film noir from director Don Siegel, which starred Eli Wallach and Robert Keith.
three decades previously, Keith was making his living on the stage, where he struck up a relationship with Peg. The two were married in 1927, and after a tumultuous union that would reverberate throughout the remainder of her short life, they divorced 2 years later.
See, Peg grew up where all these actors had all married actors. So all of the married couples in her life, for the most part, were stage people. Stage people marry stage people. We see it today. You know, film people marrying film people, for the most part. She wanted that. She saw it, she admired it, and she desperately wanted to have this kind of almost fairy tale marriage where she could be a leading. She wanted to be like, you know, Lynn Fontanne and Alfred Lunt, you know, who were the two most. In fact, you know, she knew them well because they all worked in the theater guild together. And that's how she wanted to be. She wanted a marriage like that. She wanted to be married to a professional, to a leading man, and Robert Keith certainly fit the bill. And he had been doing very well. He was living in Rudolph Valentino's Natasha Rambova-designed penthouse overlooking Central Park, you know, and Peg fell in love with that place. You know, she describes it in letters, and you're pulling when you're reading the book. And when I was researching her life, I'm pulling for Peg. I'm pulling for this marriage. I want the marriage to work. And I was always hoping, even though I know it was going to end ugly, that something would have happened, that they got back together later. And it just wasn't so. She divorced him. He'd been beating her and pulling her hair. And, you know, while they were on tour with the Theater Guild during a national tour. And it crumbled. It crushed her. And she was strong. She kept that British stiff upper lip, if you will. And she pressed on. And she did very well in the stage in spite of what was going on with her marriage. And then she came to Los Angeles at one of the last legs of the Theater Guild tour. And there's Robert Keith. He had been fired by the Guild, blacklisted from Broadway for a year or so. So he'd been working in San Francisco and doing small non-equity theater out here. And he shows up drunk at the theater in downtown Los Angeles and embarrasses her and frightens the rest of the troupe. And she ends up having a talk with him and tells him that while she does care about him and loves him, she's not in love with him and it just can't work. But it killed her. And then in the end, you know, he ends up meeting another woman, an actress in San Francisco. And, you know, Peg is following, you know, they all follow each other's careers. And Peg is reading about the success he's having. And, you know, she had spent thousands and thousands of dollars on this guy, getting him out of jail, paying his child support. You know, she marries him. She doesn't even know he has a son, you know, who became, of course, you know, Brian Keith, the actor. And, you know, in her last days, you know, one of the rungs on her ladder was I found the newspaper articles that were from the San Francisco Chronicle and the Los Angeles papers, all of them, in the theatrical sections, announcing that Robert Keith and his actress Dorothy Tierney have sold plays, and they're working together, these two, have sold a play to Booth Tarkington, who at that time was, you know, a well-known author and playwright. And, you know, so she is seeing what she wanted in her marriage. She's seeing it happen with this guy in San Francisco. And that just, I know that crushed her. She's, you know, she's a 24-year-old kid.
Yeah.
She may be experienced and she may be a veteran of the stage, but, you know, she didn't have any calluses on her heart yet.
While Robert eventually managed an impressive career rebound following the divorce, the same success did not materialize for Peg. Even so, Robert's family could not escape the cruel ironies of fate. Suicide would forever mar the legacy of the Keith family, and not just from Peg's fatal leap in 1932. Robert's son Brian enjoyed tremendous popularity in a string of films, and most notably in the television series Family Affair and Hardcastle and McCormick. But in 1997, his daughter Daisy killed herself, and 2 months later, Brian ended his own life with a self-inflicted gunshot wound. These were lives branded by extraordinary bouts of loss. It's safe to assume that the pain from her divorce was one of the rungs on the ladder that led to Peg's place at the top of the Hollywood sign on that fateful night in 1932. But it wasn't the only one.
Peg loved the Theater Guild. It was her dream. You know, stage was her life, but the creme de la creme. Peg knew that she had made it when the Theater Guild asked her to be a part of their company. But now, because of all of the public embarrassment brought on by Robert Keith's drunkenness, his disruptive attitude, his violence, he got two drunk driving arrests during the tour. You know, the Theater Guild were very, very prim and proper. Okay, the women couldn't use ill language. They were not allowed to gossip. You didn't smoke cigarettes in public. You know, they didn't care if you could smoke like a chimney, you know, in the dressing room. But when you were out in public, you represented the guild because you were the guild. You know, the men were to be gentlemen. And it was just this kind of thing of honor and this code of conduct. And, you know, they really prided themselves on this, the Theater Guild. And scandal was to be kept behind the doors. They knew people were human. People were going to make mistakes and screw up. But you just didn't bring this out in public. But now Robert Keith's drunkenness, he's out of control, and he's disrupting performances. He's abusing Peg. He's physically abusive. He's hitting her. He's threatening other members of the troupe. And so they fire him, and they blacklist him. And then when this year-long tour ends, all of the other 35 members, almost every single one of them got a contract from the guild.
Yeah,
they didn't give her anything. No contract. And I know why. I don't have anything written down, but I know the history of the guild. I studied it for the book. I know the history of all the founders of the guild. I know how they were. These people were almost Puritans. They were, you know, teetotalers. And the thing is, it wasn't that they didn't like Peg. And they certainly knew that she was a good actress. They certainly knew that, right? Because the reviews across the country are phenomenal. I mean, she stands out above everybody. But it was because they couldn't take the chance that Robert Keith would still continue to stalk her. And they just couldn't bring this anymore. One of the other things that happened was Peg had an abortion. And I found this letter where she describes the abortion. And as I mentioned in the book that, you know, back then, you know, doctors were getting 25 years to life in prison if one of their patients died on a table. And women inducing medications, like today we call it the morning after pill. But in New York at that time, that was a Class C felony, and they were giving mothers 4 years in prison if they took what they called inducing medications. And abortion was so abhorrent in New York State at that time that the New York Times didn't even use the word abortion. They called it an illegal operation or an illegal medical procedure. And everybody knew that it meant an abortion. But the New York papers would not use that word. So Peg has an abortion because she hates children, because she believes that children would only slow her down. And she writes in these letters, and I have quoted in the book, you know, she's positively rabid on the subject. She wouldn't be a mother for any man, no matter what. You know, she says she would rather see her name in the lights on a marquee on Broadway than to be in a lit college, in a lit cottage home, you know, with rugrats running around. But it was the fear of motherhood, that being a mother would interfere with her acting career, her life, you know, yeah. The thing that she was born to do, walk the boards of Broadway. So one of the other things I believe happened was that the Theater Guild got wind that Peg had an abortion. And mingled, they didn't confront her on it. But between that and the debauchery of Robert Keith bringing the embarrassment to the Guild, I think they thought, you know what, we're not going to give Peg a contract for the next season. you know, and we're only going to stick to one play that she has to do under the present contract she had. So Peg is devastated. Fear guilt tour is over. She's got this divorce. She's got all this fresh PTSD, the psychological trauma. And then Peg is in New York. Robert Keith is in San Francisco, and he's got his new wife, and he's doing his thing. And Peg is doing her thing. She's very busy. She's working pretty steadily. She has one flop, and William Brady hires her, and he was one of the big, big shot callers of Broadway that day. He was the father of Alice Brady, who you may know of, who was a great character actress, won Academy Award for My Man Godfrey. William A. Brady, he tells Peg that he's going to put her in a play with Laurette Taylor, who I said earlier was one of the queens of Broadway. You had this, like, trinity of queens, Ethel Barrymore, Billy Burke, and Laurette Taylor. And Laurette Taylor had come out of retirement after 4 years, after her husband had died. Now, Peg assumed her stage name, Peg, after seeing Laurette Taylor in a play called Peg of My Heart. So now she's going to be on stage. She's going to play the daughter of Laurette Taylor in a James Berry revival of Alice Sit by the Fire. And this is going to be a smash hit. The tickets were sold 6 months in advance. It would look had every indication of lasting 2 years on Broadway. The problem is that Laurette Taylor was a periodic alcoholic. And, you know, she was one of these girls, these great actresses. I mean, she was just a gentle soul to everyone. But she couldn't control her drinking at night. And she started not showing up. The old story is that Peg came to Hollywood after a series of flops. Now, my book completely debunks all of that. And you see that she didn't have a series of flops. And that the reason, you know, her last Broadway outing closed had nothing to do with the production value of the show. It was the tickets sold out 6 months in advance. They were going to do about a 2-year run on Broadway. Then they were going to talk. Then they had talk of taking it to England for a year and then coming back and traveling to the United States and then possibly adapting it to the screen. So there were lots of big plans for Peg with Laurette Taylor, and they got along famously with each other. And this play was amazing. The reviews are just phenomenal. But Laurette Taylor, she stops showing up, or she's showing up drunk, too drunk to work. And they try to accommodate her, but it wasn't working. So they ended up pulling it. It went dark. So Peg was out of a job.
The potential blockbuster run of Alice Sit by the Fire may have been cut short, but people in the industry knew that Peg's was a special talent. And at that tender age of 24, she had the experience and the skill that few others in her age group possessed. On the strength of that reputation, an enticing opportunity on the Los Angeles stage would soon offer Peg a glimmer of hope.
Now, at this time, out here was a playwright, a friend of Peg's from the Theater Guild named Romney Brent. And Romney Brent came out here, as you probably know, you don't try out a Broadway show in Broadway, in New York. You take it to Maine. Skowhegan is where Peg used to do a lot of her pre-Broadway tryouts. Or you come out here to the coast. So Brent came out here to the coast with a producer named Bella Blau, and they got together with two other producers out here, and they were going to do a 2-week tryout of this comedy called The Mad Hoax. And they had signed Billy Burke, who was living here in Santa Monica. Flo Ziegfeld was still alive. And then, of course, Humphrey Bogart, who was, you know, coming up. He had done a lot of Warner Brothers stuff, and he wasn't quite the Bogart of Casablanca, but he was enough to that when he signed to do this pre-Broadway show, it made all the sheets across the country. Now, what they needed was ingenue to play Billy Burke's daughter in this lighthearted comedy, and to be the love interest for Humphrey Bogart. And what happened was, you know, they put an audition out. Now, this is Hollywood. It's the height of the Depression, 1932. I found that there were 2,000 actresses listed with Central Casting out here who all fit the look and the general experience that Peg had. If you wanted a young, blonde ingenue, you wanted a, you know, a delicate, feminine girl to play the ingenue, to, you know, there were over 2,000 of them out of work here. And I don't know how many auditioned, but they auditioned for 2 weeks, and they couldn't find a suitable one because they were either, you know, starstruck by Billy Burke or they tried to upstage Billy Burke. So what happened was the two other producers here, Belasco and Coran, you know, they remembered when Peg was out here 4 years earlier with the Theater Guild, and they had seen her, and they remembered Peg. So they asked Brent, they knew he and she were friends, ask if Peg Entwistle was available, because we know that her show with Laurette Taylor went dark. So to give you an idea, because it's one thing to say, well, Betty Davis credited Peg Entwistle, okay, to become Betty Davis. That's one thing. But then the creme de la creme to me is, it's inconceivable to me at the height of the Great Depression, when theatrical producers are in film land, okay, it's inconceivable to me that you can't find an actress out here suitable enough to play Billy Burke's daughter for this supporting role. And yet, what they do is they call New York, and they ask Peg, and she doesn't recite a single line. She doesn't audition for them. They remember her from 4 years earlier, and they hire her on the spot over the phone, and then pay not only her first-class train ticket out here, but they pay for another actor. They fire an actor in the show, promising him that they will give him another role in another show somewhere, a better one, so they can hire an actor recommended by Peg so she can have a male escort on the train so she doesn't have to be on the train all alone, this pretty young 24-year-old girl. Hmm. And to me, that speaks volumes to the talent that was Peg Entwistle. And this show, when it opened, it was like a Hollywood premiere at Grauman's. They had the big spotlights out. They had the red carpet. It was live broadcast on the radio. It was a black tie affair. All of this, you know, for a pre-Broadway tryout. Flo Ziegfeld was there. All of the Hollywood A-list was there. It was, you know, all the names were there. John Gilbert was there. Garbo was there. All the names of the legendary Hollywood showed up to see this show. That was essentially just a pre-Broadway tryout. You know, that shows me that Peg Entwistle was something really special when it came to that stage.
On the heels of the successful preview run of The Mad Hopes in L.A., success in New York seemed all but assured. An offer was extended to Peg, and she delightfully accepted. But when her co-stars wavered in favor of other opportunities, Peg felt inclined to do the same, especially when RKO came calling with a proposition that was too good to refuse.
Why, Hazel, cousin.
Hello, June.
How you been, you old so-and-so?
Oh, gosh, it's good to see you.
That's one of the few scenes featuring Peg that still exists from her one and only film credit, 13 Women. This big-budget David O. Selznick production is often credited as the first female ensemble film. Even more impressive than its cast, which featured Myrna Loy and Irene Dunn, is its provocative subject matter. Undoubtedly, far too provocative for its time, as it suffered massive cuts prior to release. Peg's performance bore the brunt of most of those cuts.
When you see the film today, you see little more than a cameo appearance. Her cousin Helen told me that when it was done, the original shooting, that she thought it was the best acting that she had ever done in her life up to that point.
What's the matter, June? I'll have to tell you. I've got to tell somebody to get it out of my head. Hazel, I shouldn't go on with this act. I'm afraid.
Afraid of what?
Oh, something's been on my mind for a long time now. Didn't bother me much at first. Now it's driving me. Oh, no, no, I can't go on. What's the matter? What's happened? Do you remember that round robin letter we all sent each other?
Yes.
Well, in that letter, one of the girls mentioned how miraculous some swami in New York was in predicting what was going to happen to us.
So you sent for your horoscope?
Did you too? Well, he sent us three letters, warnings. I didn't tell my sister, Hazel. He said something terrible was going to happen to one of us.
The only print existing is about an hour long. Originally, the film was 1 hour and 57 minutes. And Peg opens the first 22 minutes of the original film as it was shot. And in it, she plays a woman who's married to a fellow who seems nice enough, but a little domineering. And as Myrna Loy is tooling around, getting her revenge against all these girls who were cruel to her in college because she was a mixed race, Peg ends up getting... Seduced by an older woman, and she becomes a lesbian. And of course, this creates problems. It was very racy. There's a scene in there where they have Peg waking up in a bed after an apparent lovemaking session, which is indicated strongly in the script, in the shooting script, and matches all the production reports. And this just leads up to the murder of her husband, where Peg murders her husband and then goes insane in the film. And 22 minutes were then whittled to 16, and then the 16 were cut even further to 4, and it destroyed her. It crushed her. It really did. If you read the entire script the way it was shot, it would have been one of the blockbusters of that season. There's no question.
The original cut of 13 Women is thought to no longer exist. With its disappearance, so goes the possibility that Peg might have achieved her immortality in a far more desirable fashion. But that was not meant to be. She was crestfallen and running out of money, and her dream of a long and distinguished career on the stage seemed more and more distant in spite of her wealth of experience and reams of celebratory notices. And her movie career seemed to have stalled before it even began. Her lowest point would soon manifest itself from the highest precipice, a platform onto which she had climbed before in happier times.
One day, Peg was on her porch at the Beechwood Drive home. It's the only road at that time in and out towards where you see now the Hollywood sign. And there was no Hollywoodland sign there. It was just a mountainside, Mount Lee. And all of a sudden, one day, Peg got really angry because she's trying to rehearse a role, and there's all these big bulldozers and tractors and these men and trucks hauling up all these big telephone poles and braces and pieces of steel. And they were heading up to the hill to begin construction on the Hollywoodland sign. So Peg not only sees the Hollywoodland sign, but then later, her and her adventurous friends and her brother, they used to go up and they used to climb it. So when Peg climbed that sign on her last night on Earth, I mean, she knew exactly where to go. She knew exactly, you know, where the ladders were, how to scale it, how to get up there, because she had done it lots of times. Her brother told me all us kids used to climb the sign.
September 16th, 1932.
Everybody knew that Peg was in dire straits, that her depression was real. You know the story that it says, you know, and after Peg died, you know, a letter arrived offering her a part in a stage play where she was to play a woman who kills herself. Well, that didn't happen at all. But what did happen was even more interesting. Now, the letter that comes, which I mentioned in the book, of course, is the letter that was mailed by Peg's grandmother, who was in New Mexico visiting other family members at the time. And she writes this letter, and it has general things. There's some family gossip in it. And then she's wondering how Peg's brothers are doing. and she's writing this letter to Jane Ross, Peg's aunt, at the Beechwood house here. And now Peg's nickname, her lifelong nickname, was Babs, which is odd because normally you associate Babs with Barbara. Right. But I believe it was because Peg saw a play with a character named Babby, and she liked that. And that's about when she started calling herself Babs, and she signs her letters Babs. The family refers to her as Babs. So the grandmother says, "I'm so sorry to hear about Babs, and I hope before this letter arrives that she gets a contract, another contract somewhere, and that she'll be all set. Tell her not to give up. There's always a better day ahead." Now, she mails this on the day that Peg jumped to her death. You know, it's dated as postmarked September 16th, 1932. And when I first read that, I just went, you know, oh, the irony of this. Here's this woman writing a letter, you know, and the letter is on its way here as Peg is walking up to the Hollywood sign to kill herself.
Yeah.
And, you know, she just didn't want to hang on another day. She just had too much. I think it was at that time it was spontaneous. She was seen. She told her family she was going to meet friends. All the indications are that she did meet the friends, and then something happened, and nobody will ever know what exactly happened. It's my belief that she was sitting at the Hollywood Land Cafe, which is still there. She probably read something. She was always reading the trade papers, and like I said, you know, there was news out about her ex-husband, and he just did this big film. Sold a play to Booth Tarkington, and he's living large in San Francisco, and she's flat broke, and she's blacklisted from Broadway, and even if she had the nerve to borrow money, she could have borrowed money, but she didn't want to put other people on the spot, and I believe what happened was that she took all of the items she had in her purse, because none of these items were found. You know, women carry stuff in their purse. Lipstick, you know, makeup kit, a little mirror, you know, hairbrushes, you know, girl stuff. None of that was found. The only thing that was in her purse was the suicide note. So I believe that she emptied on, threw away all the things personal to her in her purse, the things that would make her look pretty, to make her feel feminine, to make her feel like a girl, like a woman. And she writes this note, and she doesn't sign it Peg Entwistle, and she doesn't sign it Peg. She signs it P.E. I believe that the reason that she signed it P.E. was so that it would help the authorities identify her, because she knew how it worked out here. She knew that when they found her body, they would find the note and that her family would know who P.E. was when they read a description. That's exactly what happened. But she disassociated herself. You know, it makes sense to me that someone would have signed the letter Peg or signed it Peg Entwistle. But she signs it P.E. She wants to disassociate herself from herself to make it easier for her, to make her pain go away once and for all. The family was so devastated that they literally ignored it. They ignored it. Peg was cremated, and then they just put her ashes in a closet and to put the urn in the closet, and nobody was allowed to talk about her. Nobody was allowed to talk about it for several years. You know, she didn't get put into the ground, her remains, which were buried with her dad and stepmom Loretta in Ohio, until the following January.
Where do you think her life and her career would have taken her had she not committed suicide?
I think she would have done very, very similar to what we see with Betty Davis's career. I think in many ways. I think she probably would have done a lot of film, but mostly theater. I think she would have followed in popularity. She would have become like a Betty Davis, but she would have followed more of the theater. She probably would have married a couple more times, I think. I think she would have won several Tony Awards. She had a lovely singing voice, and I only know that because of letters I found where she's mentioned she's practicing her singing, and her cousin Helen tells me this beautiful, she says, you know, Babs had the most lovely singing voice, but because she was into legitimate theater, she never got a chance to use it, you know, because she was all, it was drama, and they didn't do any songs in drama. So, but I think she would have utilized that. She was practicing it. She was always honing her craft. There's no question that she was a prodigy. I think she would have gotten, in the end, the recognition that she longed for.
Watch me with a million eyes. Oh, sing me to sleep, lullaby of the leaves.
So how should we honor the memory of Peg Entwistle? We should begin with the truth. And when we look upon that world-famous symbol of the land where dreams are made, and our eyes gaze upon the top of that first letter, we should reflect on her all too brief existence in this world, who she was, what she accomplished, and as lovers of the arts, what we all lost when she took that fatal leap on September 16th, 1932. On the next episode of Tinseltown Tragedies.
I called her the disco Black Dahlia.
A beautiful starlet, viciously murdered.
Somebody stabbed this woman to death on a Hollywood street.
A mystery involving Hollywood's biggest stars.
If celebrities knew about Krista.
A killer who has evaded capture for 37 years.
She's a dar. I'm in over my head.
Actress Krista Helm came to Hollywood with stars in her eyes. She kept a journal of every famous figure she slept with, and even recorded these encounters. Is that why she was stabbed 22 times on February 12th, 1977?
Krista said, "What do I need that for? I just, you know, need a sugar daddy. You need a sugar daddy too."
Movie Geeks United investigates the unsolved murder of actress Krista Helm, and we uncover new revelations and new leads that could break the case wide open.
She told me in the parking lot that Krista was in some really deep shit, way over her head, and she wanted nothing to do with it.
Who killed Krista Helm? Premiering next week on Tinseltown Tragedies.